thank you for tuning in to CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly, hour-long news report, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affair coverage from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Alex DeBoer.
I'm Christina Song.
And I'm Zoe Powell.
It's Thursday, April 12th at 5:05 p.m. We're broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Today is the 2017-2018 final episode of Democracy Watch. As such, we will be approaching the show a little bit differently this week. Today, instead of presenting headlines and original reporting, we'll be revisiting past Democracy Watch stories and discussing where those stories are at now. We'll also be adding some media analysis by discussing our coverage and the coverage provided by other media outlets.
All right, so I was planning on starting this episode out by talking a bit about the show itself. I don't know how much we want to get into this, but the show is called Democracy Watch, as we just mentioned. It was previously called News 101. So this year, one of the changes we made, I actually made it myself as the News Collective coordinator, so it wasn't a super democratic choice, though it's called Democracy Watch. Democracy is slow. Someone has to start it out. Yeah. So we changed the name, and so we wanted to have a bit more of a presence of the power of journalism. And journalism obviously works to inform citizens so that they can make decisions based on facts, based on understanding the transparencies of publicly elected officials, and that they can participate fully in society and so that democracy can exist. So that was sort of the thought behind the name. It was also taken slightly inspired by Democracy Now. Objectivity does not exist. So, okay. So just wanted to touch on that. So the first story we're going to get into is a story reported on by myself, Ramatula Sheikh, and Ryan Patrick Jones on January 25th, 2018. So this story is called Tim Hortons Fight for 15. So we covered a protest that took place outside the Tim Hortons on Commercial and First. That was on Friday, January 19th. This protest was organized by Fight for 15, a campaign that took place in BC and happened at two different Tim Hortons that same day. One was in the morning, one was at night. And it was part of a day of action in support of Tim Hortons workers. So if we can recall back in January, this is around the time that Ontario's minimum wage hiked up to, I think it was $14 an hour, and it didn't do so gradually, so it was sort of sudden. And some Tim Hortons, as they are franchises, took those losses in profits out on their workers and cut benefits or cut hours and such. So this event was in reaction to that. So in this episode, we interviewed a couple people. We interviewed two activists outside of the Tim Hortons, and then we later interviewed a UBC Sauder business professor, Mark Thompson. So first, I'm just going to play a clip from a activist outside Tim Hortons. He's part of a socialist group, and let's go to that, and then we'll continue the discussion.
We first interviewed William, who's a member of the Vancouver Socialist Alternative Group. Here's what he had to say about the objectives of this planned agitation.
We're protesting the clawback of benefits and general mistreatment of workers by the Tim Hortons franchise. So they're taking away benefits, they're taking away paid breaks, and the most sort of vindictive one is that they're not allowed free drinks anymore, which when you think about how much coffee they throw away during the day because of their 20-minute fresh rule, how much food and drinks these workers are supposed to throw away throughout the day and they're not allowed to have any of it, I mean, that's just a Dickensian level of greed.
All right, yeah, so that was an activist outside Tim Hortons, and he was obviously very passionate about what he was talking about and the just sort of visceral greed of Tim Hortons. And I think we also found that in the other activist we spoke with, who was a member of QP, who was speaking about the benefits of unions for workers and how unions and a guaranteed living wage can work to obviously like give workers what they need and to prevent such actions as took place on January 19th. So we also interviewed a professor because we wanted to delve a bit more into the economics of the situation, which is something I'm definitely not an expert on. So we were interested in how this might have played out differently, like how different organizations in Canada have responded to hikes in minimum wage, and if there's a way for companies to increase minimum wage without making their workers absorb that loss in profits. So we talked to this professor, Mark Thompson. We're going to play a clip of this in a minute. And he, I chose this clip because I think it's interesting in his perspective on who these workers are at Tim Hortons. And he sort of sees them as like transient workers, possibly or likely young people. This is like, he sees these jobs as very temporary. And I sort of disagreed with him. So let's take a listen to this and then we'll talk about it.
We wanted to delve further on this topic on of minimum wage. We interviewed Mark Thompson, a professor emeritus at UBC Sauder School of Business.
Okay, so there's this contrast between raising the minimum wage from $11 to $14 right away and doing it gradually. So Tim Hortons might make the argument if you had raised the minimum wage gradually in Ontario, we wouldn't have responded in such a way, cutting workers' benefits and their hours and such. But I mean, the bottom line is that Tim Hortons wants to keep their profits margin at what it is, right? So even if they increase the minimum wage gradually, wouldn't they still find ways to make workers absorb those that increase in wages?
Well, it depends on the circumstances. They run the risk that they lose their employees. That's the first thing.
Right.
I mean, these are not, for most people, they're not career jobs. You don't expect to be pouring coffee at Tim Hortons all your life at basically a minimum wage. So, and those jobs are always, they're always available. You just walk around town and you see help wanted in front of a retail establishment. You know, it's those are minimum wage
but
jobs.
But a lot of the workers there are immigrants.
With their feet, you know.
Yeah, but a lot of the people there are maybe immigrants and don't have a lot of options. And so maybe those jobs aren't they like fairly often not just temporary jobs?
Well, they're not temporary jobs in the sense that they're always there,
right?
And but they're not jobs that you keep for life, you know. I mean, there's high turnover, and if people don't like their way being treated at Tim Hortons, they'll look around for one of the other chains, you know.
All right, so that was an interesting clip, I think. What you guys thought of it? But so, okay, so I think what we're seeing here is like a reflection in sort of a generational understanding of what coffee shop or who coffee shop workers are. So perhaps from this professor, his generation, he is seeing Tim Hortons as being a place where teenagers go to work, make some money after school, those type of things, like the kind of job you have as a first job or a second job. Or something maybe you do very part-time while you're in school or going to university, whatever. And so he says, for most people, these are not career jobs. So I think that what's interesting about this is that that's not necessarily true. If we look at Tim Hortons today, I don't know about you guys, but when I walk into a Tim Hortons, I find that generally it is women working there. And of course, this is my observation. This doesn't count for every Tim Hortons in BC or in Canada or even in Vancouver, but my observation in the Lower Mainland, and I have been to a fair few Tim Hortons. My parents love Tim Hortons, or Timmy's as it's called. Ramatula loves Tim Hortons too, but he's not here, sadly. Anyway, I digress. So when I go in there, generally I find it's like middle-aged women, a lot of like immigrants, and I mean, you have to wonder, like, is this not a career job for some people? I mean, sometimes people come to a new country or are in a situation in life where this is where they're working. And so I think that what the professor is arguing is that, you know, if these are just temporary jobs, the workers have more power, right? Because then they can quit their jobs and be like, I'm going to look for work somewhere else. Like, this is something that I wasn't going to do forever anyways. But the reality is, if that's not the case, then they're kind of trapped in these jobs a bit more than he's giving them credit for. And if they're trapped, they lose leverage. Like, what can you do if you need a job? Like, I mean, and that's kind of the whole thing here, I think. Yes.
Like, a bit of detail on the high turnover rate, I think, is that some people, I mean, there in these jobs, there probably is a higher than normal turnover rate. But how many people are quitting those jobs and going to another minimum wage job?
So right.
They're not moving up or to a job that that will give them a higher wage. They're just going to a different job, which is still falls under minimum wage. So
right. Yeah. Totally. And is it really a lot better? I mean, that's the whole thing about minimum wage is it's standardized. And in companies like Tim Hortons, like large companies with a lot of workers doing quote unquote menial work, they're going to pay whatever minimum wage is. So is it better to go work at, like, I don't know, Starbucks? Maybe. I think they do have some benefits, right?
I think Starbucks has health.
Yeah.
Health or something.
Actually, you know what? besides, Tim Hortons isn't owned by Canadian company anymore. Did you have anything to say about that?
No, I think we were kind of debating whether there will be an impact on, like, the company itself, because their shareholders might not think that it's a big deal that people are offended by their business tactics.
Right.
But actually, because they're foreign investors, but actually Tim Hortons has been getting a lot of flack overseas as well. So I think perhaps those shareholders who are, you know, probably international, but the company itself is in Brazil, they probably heard something about it and they feel that it's a risk to invest so heavily in a company that's losing popularity in Canada. And that could reflect in their stock prices.
Totally. Which might be the only reason, which is almost definitely the only reason they would make changes, right? Is they're beholden to their stock owners, their shareholders. Is what I should say. Okay, so now, just to bring you up to speed on where the story's at now. As we all know, in February, John Horgan, our BC premier, announced that minimum wage will be going up. So by 2021, minimum wage earners will now make $15.20 an hour. So just refer to my notes here. The first increase is going to come on June 1st, 2018. So that's pretty soon. And the minimum wage will go from what it is now, which is $11.35 per hour, to $12.65 per hour. So that's all well and good. That's the first step. The second one is a year from that, which is in June 1st, 2019. It goes up to $13.85. Then it's set to, in 2020, go up to $14.60. And then in 2021, go up to $15.20. So I think that these dates are still not set in stone, but this was what was recommended by the Fair Wages Commission. So that's what the plan is right now. So it's kind of interesting because, like, Christina and I were talking about this back on Monday, and so we're thinking, like, okay, so the Fight for 15 movement actually began in New York, and it began in 2012. So $15 in 2012.
In American dollars.
In American dollars. What is that compared to $15 in 2018 in Canadian dollars? And what is that compared to $15 in 2021? Like, that's bananas.
Yeah, to give a little bit of perspective, I believe a living wage in Vancouver was estimated to be over $22 in 2016. So that was 2 years ago, which means that even if minimum $15 was implemented now, it's still quite a bit under a fair living wage.
Yeah. So it's interesting. Also, just to give perspective for other places in Canada, companies in Alberta appear to be adjusting also to a hike that they had recently, which was from 12 $20 to $13.60, which is in last October. So in Alberta, our neighboring province, their minimum wage is now $13.60. And they're getting ready for further increases also to $15 this year. So we're lagging behind Alberta substantially, important to note. And then, as we all know, what spurred this all was the minimum wage hike in Ontario, which is now at $14. So right now, BC is like the most expensive place to live and pays the least for minimum wage work. So this is kind of a long time coming. But it definitely, it's like one thing we were talking about as well is like, why 15? Is that an arbitrary number?
So I think we were talking about it on Monday as well, about how it could have been because it's an alliteration.
It's alliteration for sure.
Yeah. Like, and it just
fight
sounds
for
good.
15. It sounds
fight
great.
For 20. I don't know.
Fight for doesn't 14. Have the same ring. Actually, that's not bad. The movement started in 2012 in New York City.
Maybe the minimum wage in New York City that was livable was 15.
Sorry, our news comrade Olamide has something to say.
I'm just saying that maybe, like in New York in 2012, according to like US dollars, $15 was the living minimum wage at that point in time, right?
I mean, you put that there's true. More to it than just yeah. alliteration.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm hoping for.
Yeah, you're right. You're totally right. We were just speculating.
Yes, we're speculating, of
course. We're speculating.
But we have to keep in mind that, like, for Canada, the rate of inflation is pretty close to 2% a year.
Nice.
So in 10 years, that means that there should be around 20% increase from the previous wage.
Yes. I think there's a lot of like data and like research on like basically how wages and, you know, labor and like, you know, accumulation of capital and like inflation and all that stuff. And like if you look at the trends, you see that wages and inflation haven't really been keeping up to par with each other. Like
right.
inflation, like the last 30 years, inflation has been, you know, like there's been prices have been increasing, right? And wages have more or less stayed stagnant since like the 1970s, right? So it's just one of those like interesting things that like, hey, like we can't really make the complaint that like if you increase the minimum wage that like every single business is going to suffer when like for the past few years you haven't been paying fair wages to workers for their labor, given the actual like living wage and like due to inflation, right? So yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. In the last few decades, what's good for the company has not been good for the worker.
Yeah, totally. Wow, since the 1970s, hey, that's pretty crazy. So I was looking at some media coverage of this. So we, our coverage, to analyze that a bit. Okay, so there we had some reporters, myself included, outside the Tim Hortons. So we were talking to the protesters and activists. We did try to talk to Tim Hortons workers. Included in the piece is us going up to the counter at Tim Hortons on Commercial and First and asking the workers there if they would like to speak to us. They declined. Understandable. They're probably under a lot of pressure and don't want to lose their jobs, or for whatever reason, I shouldn't speculate, they declined to speak to us. And we did not reach out to the larger corporation for comment. That's one. I doubt they would have spoken to us. Usually we try to reach out to the company at large if we're covering a protest, but most of the time they're not able to get back to us, or they send like a statement. So anyway, so we did not reach out to Tim Hortons. So that's something. I was looking at other coverage of the Fight for 15 movement and like this and the announcement of the minimum wage going up, which Horgan announced in February. And obviously, like generally the coverage depended on the news outlets' leanings. So like Global News, they were interviewing a lot of people in this one piece, and like business owners and restaurant owners, and they were all saying, you know, like, oh, I'm gonna have to fire people and stuff, like this is hard for our business to absorb. And then, you know, other sources like the Georgia Strait talk about how, you know, this is like something that will be that local businesses will be able to absorb with like predictable increases in wage. And it's really just the least the government can do considering the cost of living here. So, yeah, it really varied. But the economics of it all is really interesting to me. How many, because the real issue is How many small businesses are there who have to pay their employees a higher wage? And like, I think we calculated this as well, and it was like 30% or 40% of business in
right,
BC.
In Canada. Our small businesses, 35% of minimum wage workers are employed by small businesses.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think, well, that is quite a large chunk, but
yeah,
I think when people who are making minimum wage get a boost in their income, they're mm-hmm. not going to be spending it on some foreign investment, like people who are in higher income brackets.
Yeah, that's a really
so
good point.
So they're going to, you know, send all of this cash back into local businesses. I don't really see how protecting small businesses is a really great argument for keeping minimum wage low.
Yeah, totally. That's a good point. All right, well, we're going to go to a short break. Stay tuned. This is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. When we come back, we'll be revisiting an episode we did a couple months ago, on fish farming. So stay tuned.
LGBTQ2I Night is a positive space for folks to learn about bike maintenance in a relaxed environment led by queer mechanics and volunteers. It takes place on the fourth Wednesday of every month at the Bike Kitchen on UBC's campus. Bring your own bike and fix them with our tools, come with questions and ask away, or learn by watching other folks work on their bikes. Beginners are always welcome. This event is entirely free to attend and there will be free pizza. For more information, visit bikecoop.ca.
When you join Balloon Club, we guarantee that you will be able to make a balloon poodle within the first day.
Here at the UBC Ant Club, we just like to talk about ants and compare ant farms. It's really cool.
Paperclip Club is all about, well, paperclips mostly.
At Blah Club, you can blah blah, blah 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 blah.
Explosion.
There's only one club worth joining at UBC, and that's CITR 101.9 FM. We got free tickets to shows, whirly pops, professional help in all types of audio engineering, passes to festivals, crazy parties, live band swag. All types of crazy people. Our programming manager rides a motorcycle. There's freestyle rapping, Nardwar the Human Serviette, the vinyl and record libraries, Discorder magazine, free studio recording, and it sure beats the hell out of Paperclip Club, which is a thing that I just made up because I work at
CITR.
So come check us out on the floor of the Student Union Building. We got all types of crazy shit for you to do. Or check us out online at www.citr.ca.
Allow me to tell you about Unceded Airways.
What's that?
Isn't that some kind of indigenous radio show?
It sure is. Tell me, are you down for decolonization? Yeah. What?
I certainly wish I could hear about Indigenous issues, people, and events on the radio.
You're in luck, because Unceded Airwaves talks about all these things and more every Monday morning at 11.
Music from Indigenous artists and coverage of all the hot happenings in Indigenous art and entertainment.
On CITR 101.9 FM.
Oh, wow. And they broadcast all this from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam people?
Find out for yourself, Monday mornings at 11, or find episodes online at citr.ca.
Today we're joined in the studio by the Cedar Program Youth.
Where you are at.
Welcome back. You're listening to Democracy Watch on 101.9 FM. So the next clip we're going to play for you is our coverage of a fundraiser for the fight against fish farming at the Unitarian Church of Vancouver on February 22nd.
My name is Kwakwa Balas. My English name is Ernest Alford, and I'm from the Namqis at Alert Bay. On August 24th, that's nearly 6 months ago, we declared an occupation. My niece and myself went out to Swanson Island Fish Farm And we brought our tents and our sleeping bags, and we decided that we were going to sit there and we were going to wait until we had some clear answers about the 10-year licenses that the province has issued so these farms could operate. Now, it's a multi-jurisdictional mess because they've broken up the responsibilities between the federal government and the provincial government. But when we realized that all of the farms within the Broughton Archipelago are expiring and that the province has the authority to not renew them, we became very excited, and there's a glimmer of hope here. The provincial government has taken certain steps to, you know, reconcile with First Nations people, and they speak a different language than the previous governments that we've had, and so I'm very optimistic and feeling quite powerful that we are in fact winning this fight against this Norwegian companies.
Okay, so that was Chief Ernest Alfred of the Namgis Nation. And so a couple things have happened since then. Recently in March...
What was happening then?
Sorry. Right. Okay, so actually...
Quick recap.
Right. The event was a fundraiser and raising awareness against fish farming in BC, because there are several fish farms that are operating open net farms in BC, and the First Nations are very much against it because there have been several research pointing out that it's infecting the wild salmon, and the First Nations communities, of course, rely heavily on wild salmon and wild salmon fishing. So they're very concerned that they're going to spread piscine reovirus and sea lice, which can come because these farm salmon, which by the way are Atlantic salmon and not Pacific, they are kept in open nets, so they can easily infect any wild salmon that passes by them, which is pretty often. And I think there have been several studies, and there have been a lot of petitions, including the David Suzuki Foundation, who also sponsored the fundraiser that night, who are telling the government, you know, you really have to be concerned more about the effect of farmed salmon on British Columbia's coastal waters. Also, it seems like BC is going to be the only place where salmon farming is going to be allowed on open waters in the West Coast. That means recently Washington has passed a law outlawing farmed salmon, and it's kind of hypocritical when our sort of Canadian image is to be like a little bit more greener than our American neighbors, and we are not even doing what Seattle is doing or Washington.
Yeah, and how recently did Washington pass that policy that there's no longer open net fish Atlantic farm?
You know,
fishing?
I'm not sure about the date, but and I don't think it has been completely implemented yet, but they are phasing them out as we speak.
Okay, cool, yeah.
And I think also, but BC itself has an opportunity to phase them out as soon as this summer, because as we have spoken before, their tenure is about to expire. So these 10 years allow, they're like licenses for these fish farms to operate, and they are going to be, many of them are going to be expiring in June. And that's right. Why there has been so much movement right now.
Right, right, right. Okay. So, yeah, so where are we at right now then?
So this there's been a report from a provincial advisory council saying that BC should seriously consider getting First Nations people to grant permission before giving out the 10 years. And it doesn't seem likely that the First Nations community would give out permission because they're deeply, deeply against salmon farming, and they have been very outspoken, and they've been sitting in on protests, as like Chief Ernest Alfred has mentioned.
Right.
And but then in March, the First Nations community also filed an injunction against the restocking of fish farms because they said that, you know, if the 10 years get expired in June,
yeah,
what are they going to do with all the salmon that they just restocked?
Right.
Like, there has to be some sort of, like, way of disposing of them and these companies are going to lose profit, and they're going to cite that as a reason why tenure should continue.
Okay, so where we're at now, like, tell me if I understand this correctly, is that we're waiting for these tenures to either expire or be renewed in June. And right now, the agriculture minister is recommending that the industry or these companies get approval from First Nations.
So the minister of
agriculture
in BC hasn't said that she will, like, ask for permission. But an advisory council for the province has recommended this, and she said that she will take this under advisement.
Okay, so right now we're just hanging in the balance. Like, the fate of open net fish farming is hanging in the balance.
Yes.
And we'll find out in June.
Yes.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very serious upcoming news event.
In terms of what our coverage has added to this story, I think that's part of it as well. Like, something that's really significant is that these kind of things are normally, like, these slow burn, ongoing issues which don't make it into the mainstream news media because it's not, like, one big event. But, yeah,
right.
Like you said, the future of this is literally hanging in the balance. It's these ongoing things, and there is a lot of scope to change policies in this kind of area, but the fact that it's not covered until it becomes some sort of huge deal means that it's not really in the public awareness a lot. So I thought Christina's piece on it, like, really sort of broke into that, like, I don't know, temporal disjuncture that the mainstream media has with these kinds of issues.
Ooh.
And actually brought it into the light. So watching democracy, you know,
wow,
that's our mandate.
Disjuncture.
Wow. Thank you.
So he's very smart.
And also very flattering.
What are you, in grad school or something?
I paid $5,000 for that word.
Yeah.
Still got student debt.
No, that's true. That's a really good point. Because we have covered this because of Christina's interest and work in it. Not work, but willingness to cover these events. But it hasn't really taken a large spot in the general news media, in the mainstream. I would say, to your comments, Zoe, is that probably speaks to the lack of funding for journalism. That, you know, we being, like, the industry has to prioritize stories that are the most, quote-unquote, newsworthy. And so, you know, something that's sort of a slow burn story perhaps won't receive as much coverage as would be ideal.
Right. And I think it also it's sort of part of, like, who benefits from having this story being shared. And it's for Trans Mountain, I think, like, there has been a lot of coverage, but only because there has been massive protests and it's so incredibly visible. But
yeah.
But for these small First Nations communities, they are not nearly as visible.
Yeah, and it's sort of a regionalized issue in that it's, like, on the coast of the ocean. And so if you're not directly consuming the salmon there or the wildlife, you might overlook it. Whereas the Trans Mountain Pipeline, you know, affects everyone and is going through a large geographical region. Though, I mean, of course, like, salmon, people eat salmon from all over, but... But yeah, I'm not saying salmon isn't super important.
Everybody likes sushi.
People like sushi. Yeah, that is very true. Anything else to say on this piece?
Nope, I'm good. I think I said what I wanted to say.
Well, you've done great work. I think we'll just go to, should we go to Zoe to talk first on... Zoe Power, our news comrade, who has been a part of the collective for, I think, the second semester, first semester too?
No, just the second one.
Just the second semester of school. However, she had a class on the date of our show this time, Thursdays at 5.
Thanks, Trevor.
So this is the first, because exams are now happening and school is actually over for the semester. Technically, classes are over. This is her first actual show she's attending. So welcome, Zoe. And if you want to tell us about a story that you liked or want to say something about from Democracy Watch this year, please. Please go ahead.
Right. Yeah, it's terrifying in the studio. It's a high-paced game.
Right.
So I have very bad reading comprehension. So when Alex asked the collective members to pick a story that they liked from the semester, I picked an entire episode of Democracy Watch. It was an episode that I had literally nothing to do with the reporting of. Maybe that's why it was such a good episode. Who knows? But it's the episode from March 15th. And the topics that we covered in this episode was, there was a extensive audio report from the Tibetan Uprising Day rallies in downtown Vancouver near the Chinese embassy. We covered the release of the Carnegie Community Action Project housing report for 2018 and had an interview with someone who put that out. And we also, our reporter Arika Riaz was interviewing the Rabbi David Masavir, who was defending himself in court that day against an injunction issued by Kinder Morgan. So what I thought was really beautiful about the way this episode worked is that two of these are, well, one of them is an exceptionally local issue, right? Like housing in the downtown east side, sort of the decline of SROs is a very local lower mainland issue, something that definitely doesn't make it into a lot of headlines across Canada. The Kinder Morgan versus the Rabbi issue is, I guess, somewhere in the middle. Definitely a lower mainland focus, but also more relevant across all of Canada as well, as we were just saying.
Yeah.
But we also covered, this Tibetan Uprising Day rally, which would seem, I guess, to me, before I listened to the episode, to not necessarily be strictly within the Democracy Watch mandate. It's this big global issue, right? It's not lower mainland specific, but actually the way that this report was done, like, really expertly focused it on the lower mainland and on how this dynamic has been changing within that community here over the last few years. So we've got this audio clip from that piece reporting on the Tibetan Day uprising that we're going to play for you right now.
And to honor those who have given their lives to resist Chinese colonization, this is where the demands become louder. While at the protest, the Democracy Watch team met Laden Tatong. She has been attending the Uprising Day protests in Vancouver at the same spot since she was a kid. We asked her about the significance of the protest.
So my name is Laden Tatong, and I am here protesting for Tibetan freedom and for Tibetan independence from Chinese rule. I grew up actually here. I don't live here anymore, but I grew up on Vancouver Island, coming here every year to protest with my family, with our very small but very feisty Tibetan community here in Vancouver, coming to this very location outside the Chinese consulate to demand freedom and to shine a light on them for what they're doing in Tibet, for the human rights violations, all the things that they hope the world will not see or will forget. In terms of what they're doing to 6 million Tibetans inside Tibet over the past six decades. Every year when we come here, we let this day serve as a reminder both of the history that Tibetans inside Tibet rose up March 10th, 1959, and that led to the escape of the Dalai Lama, but also to bring attention to the issue and the ongoing occupation, the repression, but most importantly, the resistance that continues even to this very minute inside Tibet.
How has the resistance here in the lower...
Yeah, okay, so what you actually hear right there at the end of the clip is Alex's next question for Ladon, who they're interviewing, is about how the resistance in the lower mainland and in the Vancouver community specifically has changed over the years as well. So what I thought was really impressive about the reporting on this piece was, first of all, it gave an extensive backstory about what Uprising Day actually is. And I think in news coverage of Tibet, it can tend to sort of the details of what's actually happened in the past can tend to be pretty absent sometimes. There's either a lot of assumed knowledge or a lot of silence on this topic, but also this focus on making this issue a local issue. So Ladan was speaking extensively about the sort of the power of the Tibetan diaspora around the world and here in the Lower Mainland especially. And she goes on to sort of talk about how recognition of this issue has really changed over the last few years. In terms of what was contained within the report, what was actually being reported on, maybe I'll even pass this on over to Alex, who was actually there on the day. But what they were covering was a protest which is held every year annually in the same place outside the Chinese embassy in Vancouver. And yeah, it's on the anniversary of Uprising Day. You can probably say more about this.
Yeah, I mean, Uprising Day is, it's kind of twofold. It's both a protest and a commemoration of the loss of lives that took place on March 10th, 1959. At that time in history, Tibet was in the process of being colonized by China. And so the Chinese were in the Tibetan capital of Lhasa, and there was a perceived threat to His Holiness the Dalai Lama's life. There was a request for him to come, like the Dalai Lama, to come to like some show or some meeting alone without any of his usual cohort or bodyguards. And so people thought that perhaps there was an assassination attempt in the works. Anyway, a bunch of Tibetans rose up in Lhasa and kind of crowded around the location, the building that they thought he was in, to protect him, though he actually wasn't in there. And the Chinese army opened fire on them, so thousands were killed. So this commemoration day happens every year outside the Chinese consul in Vancouver, which is at Granville and 16th, and it's meant to commemorate that loss of lives and to celebrate the courage of those who rose up and to continue rising up against human rights abuses in China and in occupied Tibet, which are enormous. And so, yeah, it happens every year. That's Uprising Day.
Yeah, and it is, I mean, perhaps a pretty depressing story to put on a spreadsheet about where was this story at and where is this story now? Because it's obviously a slow-moving issue.
Yeah.
But one thing that did really come out from the report, I think Ladan was talking about it, and you've kind of touched on it now as well, is the fact that just the awareness and recognition of the human rights violations happening in Tibet have, like, increased dramatically over the last few years. I wouldn't say necessarily since this report on March 15th, but over the last couple of decades, certainly. And there is, here in the Lower Mainland community, there are events happening to educate people about this, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, as Zoe said, well, first of all, I'd like to acknowledge that this issue is not really local, like Uprising Day itself. But, you know, in commenting on the local Lower Mainland Tibetan Canadian community, I think that what's maybe changed since then, since this protest and commemoration happened, is not a ton politically. However, one thing I did notice recently is that DOXA, Vancouver's Documentary Film Festival, actually has an amazing program. It's a self, what's it called? What's it called when people study, like, another culture?
Anthropology?
No, but
Ethnographic,
thank you. That's the word. It escaped my mind. So it's a self-ethnographic collection of short films made about Tibetans by Tibetans. So it's kind of, like, challenging that sort of, like, Western ethnographic, National Geographic kind of subject viewer kind of relationship. So it's actually, as I said, 11 short films, and they take place in three different programs at DOXA, three different shorts programs. I'm super excited to see them. But why this is significant is that it's hard for, like, in Tibet, you can't have a picture of the Dalai Lama. You can't I think you can practice Buddhism in a limited sense, but like the culture is being disrupted in so many ways. Traditional herding has been essentially like removed, like the nomadic life. People have been resettled into like permanent homes. The Tibetan language is disappearing even from like the capital Lhasa and being replaced by Mandarin. So to hear stories from Tibetans about them, to have those actually made in Tibet and brought out to the West, to the rest of the world, is actually really amazing. And I think these were probably safe to leave Tibet because they aren't overtly political in nature, I'm imagining, because there's obviously a lot of like censorship. And if you were to make a film critical of Tibet in Tibet, you would probably face a lot of danger to the safety of yourself and your family. Anyway, so what's new is that at least, you know, as Laden mentioned, it seems that there is more general awareness of what is happening in Tibet and like maybe more of an effort, at least locally in Vancouver, to showcase the stories of Tibetans.
Yeah, and I think this story is sort of like about how, even though for people who are actually in the locale where this event is occurring, their hands are tied to change the circumstances that they're in. However, through diplomatic pressures, I think the Chinese government can, you know, I think diplomatic pressure is easier for us to enforce rather than for the people inside.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's a really good point. Another person we spoke to in that episode is Maddie Burnaby, who has been a Tibetan activist for a long time. She's super knowledgeable. I think she also did her PhD in some sort of like Tibetan history. And so she's also been involved in advocating the Canadian government to regulate Canadian mining companies. You know how BC has like 70-80% of the world's mining companies based in BC. Obviously, there's sort of economic incentives for that. So she was part of a group lobbying to have this one group. I think it was China Gold, maybe. It could be another group. I'm not sure. A certain mining company to enforce human rights standards and environmental standards while in Tibet. And she and the other activists and organizers were successful in doing that. So absolutely, like, within Tibet, you can't do anything, really. And what, as you know, most people probably know, Tibetans often do is self-immolate. Am I saying that right?
Yeah.
Which is obviously super, super tragic. So there's not much people can do. I mean, there's no democracy, obviously, and there's no freedom of protest. So absolutely, just having these people continue to come out every year to this protest means a lot. And obviously, if they also, like, they're risking, if they have any family in Tibet, like, that's super dangerous. Like, there are security cameras outside the consul, and they know who everyone there is. Like, they know who you are. And so it's like, you kind of are, like, Maddie, for example, is like, I know I can never go to Tibet again. Like, she's not Tibetan, but has spent time there and is very rooted in the Tibetan community. Anyway, so it's a risk even for people here, but
it's infinitely worse.
Yeah,
in Tibet.
Yeah, and you can actually accomplish something through, as you were saying, like diplomacy and advocacy at the like, government levels. Mm-hmm. So
and corporate levels.
Sorry. Yeah. And corporate levels, yeah. Totally.
A big part of that as well is that these efforts to sort of advocate on those levels need to actually receive media attention and coverage as well, or they won't be successful. And I think, in terms of what you were saying at the start of the show about changing our name from News 101 to Democracy Watch, I think like these last couple of stories, both this one and the one about the fish farming, are not really like News 101 stories, to be honest. Like, it's not about covering an event that's happening right now, but it is about bringing coverage to an ongoing issue of sort of injustice and violence, which is not going to receive a lot of attention necessarily otherwise. So I don't know, Democracy Watch, good name, I would say. Good mandate.
My goodness, thank you so much. No, that's a good point to bring it back to, you know, media analysis. I think that this show, like, when I believe that there was no other coverage of this event. I'm pretty sure.
That was yes. one of the reasons. Oh, sorry.
Sorry. I just want to say, where is Richard Gere on this now? Because, like,
he loves the Dalai Lama. They're friends.
They're friends, but, he's not making speeches at, board shows anymore. Well, maybe that's just his flagging star power. But
and where is Richard Gere on fish farming?
I know.
When did he last come through for us?
No, but really, I think I just heard this thing. I don't know where, but it was so irritating to me when I heard it. Was that Tibet was a co-celeb in the 90s, and then it sort of faded out.
Yeah.
So I think
you probably heard that from me.
Oh, really? Well, you weren't being irritating, but the fact of the situation itself was irritating. You know what I mean?
I mean, yeah, it's that's why I was also surprised with Laden talking about how it's gotten more popular, because I feel like I think that there are sort of waves of when knowing what's happening in Tibet is trendy, and Richard Gere and what's her name? Goldie Hawn, I believe, also made speeches at the Oscars or something about, free Tibet when the issue was popular in the 90s. But yeah, it kind of ebbs and flows. But yeah, I don't know. Zoe, did you have anything else to comment on for that story?
No, I mean, in terms of what you're just saying now about those ebbs and flows, though, I think that's, interesting context for all of the things that people are saying are, hugely changing in the media today because people are talking about them at award shows as well. Maybe depressing context, but the fact that you're saying, it peaks and then attention of this issue kind of disappears and the attention can disappear itself as well.
Yeah.
Sounds like a depressing outlook for, the Me Too movement and all of that.
And people who are organizers of movements such as Me Too, I think they're, very, very aware that they have a certain time span in which they can raise awareness and create change before the next thing comes along.
Yeah, and that's definitely true. So we have just, a couple minutes here. I thought I would maybe just mention how...
Speech.
Tell him about the cake.
Oh my goodness, that's amazing. Christina made a cake for us. You may have seen it on Twitter.
It's not fake.
I know, I'm speaking to a huge group of people right now. A huge cohort of loyal followers who follow us on Twitter, Instagram. We don't have an Instagram. Facebook. CITR.ca. And so something's playing. No, maybe on my computer. I can hear something in the background. Anyway, okay, what I wanted to bring up was that Metro News is now owned by or rebranded as Vancouver...
Star Media.
Yeah, Star Media, but it's Vancouver Star Metro.
Oh.
Does everyone see that?
I did not see that.
Star Metro Vancouver.
I did listen to Cannibal.
We talked about, yeah. Star
because
Metro Vancouver.
We need yet another reminder that we live in the fringes of Canada.
Uh-huh. Well, I honestly get a lot of news from Metro, and one thing that is great is that they've hired, 12 new reporters and have this big push. How many?
I think 12.
Yeah. And they have this big push for local journalism and investigative journalism, which are obviously the two fields that most need funding and new reporters. I will definitely agree with that. It'll be interesting to see what else changes with this. And I'm interested also, I think, when this was talked about on Canada Land, the question of whether Torstar, who owns Star Metro Vancouver and all the other Metro papers, is planning on getting some of that federal budget that was allotted for journalism, whopping $10 million. So I don't know. Be interesting to see both how that's paid for, how it pays off, and how the reporting changes.
I wonder if this is sort of a ploy to get that federal grant.
Yeah, it might be.
We're just increasing our local fund or local journalism. So
yeah, they're probably marketed it that way.
A pretty significant structural force in funding for the industry as well is responding to changing government grants and restructuring your company to gain those. Yeah,
it has been. It is for the CBC. I don't know historically. I don't think there's been a lot of or any government funding for newspapers. Is that true?
I think this is one of the first.
I'm sort of just saying that with no actual knowledge,
from what I've heard.
Yes.
AKA
this is how we operate.
yeah. It doesn't seem like there's been a lot of funding just for journalism because journalism historically has been profitable, I'm guessing.
Yes, until it has now. Been in the past. Until but, now.
And yeah. now Democracy Watch has an Instagram account, so no one needs traditional journalism anymore.
That's true. Yeah. Okay, so I hope you enjoyed this eclectic episode of Democracy Watch. This is our final episode for the school year. The reason I say the school year is because we may still do... that was a drum roll. We may still do a condensed or less frequent version of Democracy Watch over the summer.
Summer.
Oh my like, oh, God. No, the audience is thrilled. So, yeah, ends. So stay tuned on social media for updates on when that and if that smaller version of Democracy Watch will continue existing because we do love covering local news. And we have to get off the air now, but thank you so much for listening.
We have cake to eat.
We have cake to eat. Come by the station.
Wait for us with bated breath.
If you, listener, want some cake, come by CITR 101.9 FM and you can have some cake. That's our promise to you.
Is that a security issue?
This is Vancouver's number one source of community adversarial news, mostly run by volunteers. And based on those categories, I think that's true. Mm-hmm. Okay. Have a great night. Ola's like, get off the air. Okay, thank you. Thank you.